Thank you very much for the welcome. I'm delighted to be here after so many years reading about you in the bulletin from very far away in South America. It's great to be here and, of course, to renew fellowship with so many of you whom I've known over the years. And I'd like to thank you as well for the opportunity to address the subject of the situation of the church in Latin America. Is Latin America going Protestant? That is what I want to talk about, and in particular, I want to consider the situation as we see it in Peru, which is the country in South America that I know best. In April last year, the Peruvian nation, 22 million of them, or at least those who had the vote, went to the polls to elect a new president and a new government. The main candidates in the run-up to the election were from the established political parties of Peru, and I won't go into them, but they sort of cover the spectrum from the far right to the far left. And it made our media, unusually for Latin American politics, because of the candidacy of one particular man, Mario Vargas Llosa, a world-renowned novelist, was the candidate of a coalition of the right. Among the candidates was someone whose chances were regarded as virtually zero. His background was Japanese. His parents had been immigrants to Japan sometime earlier in the century. Rector of the Agricultural University in Lima, Albert Fujimori. And in the run-up to the elections, we had, of course, opinion polls like we have here, and only a few weeks before the election, he was getting the remarkable prediction of 1% of the vote. He was a no-chancer. There was just no hope. In the event, he polled 32% of the vote and became one of the two candidates. The other was the novelist in the runoff later in the year for presidency. In that runoff, he trounced the novelist so that a man who had spent no less than $20 million on his campaign, the novelist, saw himself pushed into political oblivion by a man who had managed to gather together a mere $200,000 and ran his campaign from the back of a trailer pulled by a tractor. Now, what is it that brought about the difference? Where did this man, who came from nowhere politically, with a party that had no previous history, called Change 90, how did he come to power? The answer lies in the fact that Fujimori built a network of support among the evangelical churches of Peru. And many of his candidates on his slate for parliament were evangelicals. And they brought to his campaign the image of honesty, uprightness, rectitude in government, an end to corruption. As a result, in the two houses in Peru today, where there are 180 deputies in the lower house, 80 senators in the upper house, there is a total of 24 evangelicals. In November last year, I don't know if this piece of news made the Scottish newspapers. I got it from The Independent. November 12th, Guatemala, this time in Central America, outsider takes surprise lead in Guatemalan poll. His name was Serrano, Jorge Serrano, and the last bit of the news article said that some months before this election in Guatemala this time, Mr. Serrano registered just 1% of the vote, and he was being discounted as an also-ran. One line mentioned in this article that Mr. Serrano was an evangelical. The Times, January 8th, 1991, last week. Evangelical outsider is to lead Guatemala. Jorge Serrano won the presidential election and will form the incoming government in Guatemala, in Central America. Now, how does he come to power? Well, says the newspaper, this evangelical outsider owes his victory to his extensive network in the evangelical churches of Guatemala. We're talking about events taking place in Central and South America in a part of the world which we have traditionally viewed as Roman Catholic. And yet in two quite different countries, we have presidents who have come to power through the influence of evangelical churches. In the one country, Peru, evangelicals number something like about 5% of the population of the 22 million. In Guatemala, the figure is significantly different, and evangelicals would number at least 20% of Guatemala's population. I should at this point pause to let you know that in Central and South America, Protestants are known as evangelicals. The name Protestant is very rarely used. They are known as evangelicos or evangelistas. And that in itself is a witness to the character of the Protestant Church in Latin America. It is, by and large, evangelical in its character. We have only a very small element that you would call liberal in Latin America. And it's not only in the world of politics that this phenomenon is receiving attention. This book, from which in part I took the title of my talk, published last year by the University of California Press by David Stoll, Is Latin America Turning Protestant? The Politics of Evangelical Growth. Or a book published here in Britain by Blackwell's last year as well, by the British sociologist David Martin, Tongues of Fire, The Explosion of Protestantism in Latin America. It's something that political scientists, sociologists, phenomenologists are suddenly turning their attention to. Of course, it's something that other people have been aware of for some time, most notably the Roman Catholic Church. And I have to thank Trevor for his quite enlightening talk this morning. I found it rang so many bells in my own experience in the Latin American situation. In recent years, as we've seen the Polish Pope travel around the globe, one of the central focuses of his visit has been Latin America. It responds to certain situations there, the falling numbers coming forward for the priesthood, the inroads of secularization, the radicalization of priests, and most notably the influences of the theology of liberation. But one of the reasons which gets very little press coverage in European media, one of the reasons for his visits to Latin America is a recognition of the inroads being made by evangelical churches in what is traditionally a Roman Catholic subcontinent, called quite regularly sects by the Roman Catholic Church in South America, except when the Pope has to clarify this, and he makes it clear then that no, he's really talking about the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Adventists and not the historic churches. But it is a recognition of the presence and the growing presence of evangelicals in Latin America. And so in each of his major speeches, wherever he be, whether he's in Mexico or in the heart of the Peruvian Andes, he includes in his speeches a very pointed reference to the fact that they must beware of people who would take away from them their own religion. And he goes to some pains to explain to them that their culture is Catholic, and it is their culture which is under threat from these evangelicals. And so there is a recognition as well on the part of the Roman Catholic Church of the presence of evangelicals in South America. Every bishop's council throughout Central and South America has had a commission examining what they call the new religious movements, which is a kind of umbrella term which embraces the the evangelicals. Not only to examine this phenomenon, but also to ask the question, what can we learn from what is happening in the religious world around us? It isn't, of course, only the evangelicals that raise these questions. In a country like Brazil, there is the resurgence or the emergence of religious groups based on African phenomena. Tremendous presence of people of African origin in Brazil has led to groups like Macumba, Candomblé, Umbanda, all of African origins, with millions of adherents in Brazil today. And so that's another phenomenon that the Catholic Church is trying to understand. Well, where do we start when we think about Protestantism in Latin America? The very earliest attempts to establish a Protestant presence in Latin America took place in the 16th century. One on the coast of Venezuela, a sort of Lutheran attempt to establish itself, which only lasted for a few years and disappeared. Another on the Brazilian coast, which was a group of French Huguenots who were provided with a Geneva pastor by Calvin, and again that lasted only a matter of a few years. It is only really with the wars of independence from Spain last century in the 1820s, it is only those developments which really begin to open the door to a Protestant presence in Latin America, where the hegemony of Spain and Portugal was broken, And then you had the inroads being made by all sorts of new currents of thought coming from Europe, particularly from the Enlightenment. The whole ideas of liberty, of tolerance, and so on. And in that context, the door was opened, linked, as it was, to a whole wave of anti-clericalism in the aftermath of the struggle for independence. So we find, for instance, all sorts of groups going to the more temperate parts of South America. And one of the most significant names for Scots is the person who is regarded as the first Protestant missionary in Spanish America, unknown in his own country, but, as I'll mention later, of tremendous importance to the evangelical churches in South America, James Thompson, who left Haldane's tabernacle in Leith Walk, Edinburgh, in 1818 to go to Argentina, where he would further the work of the British and Foreign Bible Society and the British and Foreign School Society. A man who had a remarkable career in South, Central, and North America before he finally went to Spain and North Africa. He is one of the, what the Latins called, the precursors, the sort of advance guard of evangelicalism in South America. But throughout last century, the growth was really very slow. It took place really amongst immigrant communities. The groups, for instance, of Lutherans who went to Argentina, as an example, all sorts of different groups migrated to South America, and they took with them their own particular church affiliation. And up to about 1900, what you get is this Protestant presence, but within the confines of the immigrant group. There isn't any real projection beyond that. And this kind of thinking is, of course, confirmed by the 1910 Edinburgh Conference, which stated that mission to South America wasn't necessary because it was already Christian. And of course, this in its turn gave rise, or gave a renewed impetus to evangelical agencies, some of which were already working there, and some of which came into being as a result of it, like the Evangelical Union of South America, founded in 1911, in the aftermath of that conference, as a response to that decision of the Edinburgh Conference. Before that, one of the most significant groups to play a part in the Latin American scene was the agency represented many years before by Thompson, the Bible Society. And whether it was the British and Foreign Bible Society or the American Bible Society or other entities, during the 19th and early 20th century, the colporteurs of the Bible societies were really assiduous in their distribution of the scriptures, Portuguese and Spanish, throughout the continent. It is only in this century that you see the advent of missions, as we know them, to the Latin American scene. And again, one of the notable figures in Latin American missionary history is a Scot, John A. Mackay, who went to Peru around about 1916, and although he was only worked in Peru for a matter of 9 years, his impact on the country and latterly on evangelicals as a whole has been quite profound. And I'll return to Mackay later, the author of a remarkable book, The Other Spanish Christ, where he drew on not the traditional image that we have of Roman Catholicism and the Christ of Roman Catholicism, but on that other face of Spanish Christianity, going back to Teresa de Avila and other people influenced by the early waves of Erasmianism in Latin America. The very first missionaries, Catholic missionaries, who went to Latin America went influenced by the thinking of Erasmus. They were before Trent. And Mackay, therefore, had a profound influence. He was with the Free Church. And like many other missionaries of his generation, saw the importance of developing schools, educational work, and so on. It is really only since the end of the Second World War that you get the missions opting out of those kind of institutional mission in Latin America and moving into much more direct evangelism. And what we have seen, particularly since the end of the 60s, is quite literally an explosion of evangelical churches in Latin America. But the largest part of that evangelical presence comes not from the immigrant groups or from the groups related to missions. It is that group which come from the sort of independent, Pentecostal, charismatic Latin American churches. And that is the wing that has exploded in the past 20 years. So that today, we would be talking about something like 70% of all Latin American evangelicals would fall into that category. They would be part of the, if I could just call it, the wide Pentecostal phenomenon. Not necessarily linked with the missions or with the immigrant churches. There are, of course, many explanations as to why we should be in this situation. People like the Stolls and the Martins of the world examine and try to analyze the reasons for it. You get, for instance, the whole changing economic and cultural situation in Latin America, and particularly with the influence of North America and the United States. This kind of economic and cultural penetration has awakened the interest of the churches in North America in mission possibilities, and they have taken advantage of the doors that have been opened to them. That is the changing social and intellectual situation in Latin America, which made people more accessible to a different presentation of the Christian faith. There has been, and this is most notable in the Pentecostal churches, the active participation of Latin Americans in the promotion and direction of their work, which has made Protestantism better adapted to Latin America. And if I could make a comment on something which was already said, whether evangelical is an adjective or a noun, in Latin America, evangelical is a verb. It's something that you do. And so the participation of the laity, the mobilization of ordinary people, is one of the key reasons for growth. from the point of view of missions, of course, that there has been a strategic relocation of resources. The Asian wars, the post-Vietnam situation, has meant that large numbers of missionaries who previously worked in Asia have relocated, not only in Asia, but also in Latin America, contributing new methods, new policy for mission work in Latin America. And of course, they've been backed up by the tremendous economic power of evangelical churches in North America, which, it has to be said, brings with it other implications, such as the missionary support for the politics of North America in Central and South America, which, to me at least, has had a disastrous effect. But that's one of the aspects of evangelicalism, or one of the wings of evangelicalism in Latin America today. And I hope to come back to that. And so in their different ways, these things have contributed to the growth of the church in Latin America. And one other dimension which must be mentioned is the shift of population from rural areas to urban areas. The urbanization of Latin America has been a crucial factor. You have Mexico City today, 20 million people in one vast conurbation. The capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires, 10 million people. Peru, Lima, with 8 million people. Over a third of the population of that country lives in the capital. Today, in Peru, something like 1,000 people arrive from the rural areas every day to live in the capital. Now, in that situation of total social dislocation, people who have had an evangelical experience in the rural areas, which is where evangelical missions have concentrated their activities, amongst the tribes, amongst the mountains people, that earlier work is now having its fruit in the urban areas, as those displaced people begin their own churches in Latin America's mushrooming shantytowns. So today, we can think of Latin American countries which have as much as 20% of their population evangelical. In Guatemala, which probably has the highest percentage, informed observers would say that we are thinking in terms of 25% of the population as evangelical. Peru, as I said, I think the most accurate figure would be about 5%. Argentina, which is a very different kind of country, a much more urbane, educated country than Peru or Guatemala, we're now thinking of something like 8% of the population would be evangelical. In the years following the Falklands War, 1983 to 1988, one of the little reported aspects of church life in Argentina was a tremendous moving of the Spirit of God, and people throughout that five-year period, regular conversions, tremendous growth of the church in Argentina in these post-war, post-Falklands War years, as people grappled with the enormity of what had happened in their country, not only in the defeat in the Falklands, but in the tragic events that had happened under military rule, disappearances, deaths and torture and so on. And this whole sense of disillusionment seems to have sent Argentine people back to ask the question, what was life all about? there may be something like 35 million evangelicals in Latin America, Central and South America today. And of these, probably 15 or 16 million would be in Brazil, Latin America's largest country. And as they come into not only religious but political prominence today, they come at a time when the subcontinent as a whole is just racked by conflict and by uncertainty regarding its future. It interests me that the Colombian novelist García Márquez, who won the Nobel Prize in 1982 for literature, in his latest novel, based on the life of the great Latin American liberator, Simón Bolívar, the book is called The General in His Labyrinth, epitomizes so much of, if you like, the contemporary angst of Latin American intellectuals in the wake of the collapse of international socialism. It's a very angry novel. And as he goes through the experience of Bolívar, who had this tremendous dream of not only liberating all these republics, which he did, but bringing them together in a sort of United States of Latin America, which he didn't achieve, seeing the collapse of the dream of Bolívar, it's as if the author is sort of reliving this and is angry and furious and trying to struggle with his own mortality and facing up to some of the fundamental questions of human existence. He seems to me to epitomize the contemporary crisis of thinking in Latin America today. And it's in that situation that evangelicals suddenly come on to the stage in a political sense. And this crisis is seen, I think, most acutely in a country like Peru. Peru, with its 22 million population, the vast majority of whom are poor and urban. Peru, with its 10,000% inflation rate in 1990, if you can take that in. Peru, with its virtual civil war, which has now been raging for 10 years, between the Shining Path guerrilla movement, a Maoist kind of movement whose nearest president in recent times is the Pol Pot movement in Cambodia. Peru, with its new government, no political experience, and there at the heart of it, trying to understand what it's all about and to work out why God has brought them to the kingdom for such a time as this, are the 24 evangelicals. It's an unenviable situation for them to be in. And it's to Peru I want to turn my attention now. Perhaps before I do that, just one comment on the Roman Catholic Church, since this has been very much in our thinking this morning. What does the Roman Catholic Church, or what is it, in which way is it being influenced by this growing evangelical presence? I think in Latin America we see what I would say three main influences, and I'll be very brief with these. One is, and this has already been referred to, is the role of the Bible in the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America. The Bible has come onto center stage in the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America. This is seen most notably last year, in the 6th World Congress of the World Catholic Federation for the Biblical Apostolate, held in Bogota, Colombia. A world conference, but the theme that they addressed was the Bible in the new evangelization. And one of the leading advisors there was the Brazilian Carlos Mestres, the man who, more than any other, has been responsible for bringing the Bible to the heart of the Brazilian Catholic Church, especially through the base community movement. And so you get the Catholic bishops in Brazil making a request for 2 million Bibles to try to meet the need of some 80,000 Bible study groups in Brazil. This is one of the effects that we see in Latin America. It also has European roots, as we've heard in the Second Vatican Council, but the interaction with the evangelical church is quite notable. Another effect is the growing role of lay leadership in the Catholic Church in Latin America. Again, as they have looked at evangelical churches and seen the way they have mobilized the laity, they have taken a leaf out of their book. It has other ingredients as well, as we've heard, but the evangelical presence has been very important there. And the third element is the importance of close-knit fraternal groups. They've seen how the evangelical churches function, and so phenomena like base communities, which we hear a lot of here, owe in part their origin to the interaction with the evangelicals in Latin America. But that was, if you like, an aside. Let me come back to Peru. I've mentioned the precedents and the names of James Thompson and John A. Mackay feature very prominently in the thinking of Peruvian evangelicals, and not just Peruvian evangelicals, but much more widely. An evangelical teacher training college opened 5 years ago in Lima to train particularly evangelicals, young people from evangelical churches, but not exclusively young evangelicals, but to train teachers, bears the name of James Thompson in its Spanish form, Diego Thompson. Here you have a church emerging and trying to find models for action in the contemporary world. And they go back to a man like James Thompson, who brought together the whole idea of the Bible and education, popular education. And they find in him a model for action as they begin to create their own history, not the history that they've been taught by Marxist lecturers in Peruvian universities, who interpret evangelicalism within a certain framework. But as they begin to develop their own self-understanding, they find models in people like Thompson, models in people like John A. Mackay, with his own interaction in his own day with the politicians of his day, with the philosophical ideas of his day. It was Johnny Mackay who took to Peru the thinking of the Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno. And his involvement with people who were later to become the political leaders of Peru, again, serves as a model for Peruvian evangelicals. So we can find a journal like this, Reforma, from Spain, and in its latest issue, there's an article on John A. Mackay, one of those figures forgotten in his homeland, but of vital importance in Latin America. The article written by Peruvian Samuel Escobar. What can we say then about the growth of the evangelical churches in Peru? Inevitably, part of the growth relates to some of the factors I've already mentioned. But there are peculiar national characteristics. One of the major factors in the growth of the evangelical churches in the Peruvian mountains, in the Quechua-speaking population of Peru, which even today is about half of Peru's population, was a left-wing military revolution. Now, you don't get many left-wing military revolutions in Latin America, but in 1968, one took place. They instituted an agrarian reform to dismantle completely the system of landowning of big haciendas that existed. And with that reform, which in agricultural and economic terms was a complete disaster, with that reform they took apart the social system that had been in place for centuries. The alliance between the landowners, the local priests, and the judiciary. As an aside here, we ought to bear in mind that there was another side to the Catholic Church as well, because it is in 1968, when this left-wing revolution is taking place, that Gustavo Gutierrez, a Peruvian priest, is writing what would become his Theology of Liberation. His rough draft, if you like, was first tried out in 1968 in Peru at the time of this left-wing revolution. So the Roman Catholic Church in Peru has not just the part allied to the big landowners, it had a radical part as well. But the revolution undid this alliance. And that was one of the major stumbling blocks to the advance of the gospel in Peru, in the mountains. The landowners relied on the priests through the confessional to tell them about any incipient movements, revolts, rebellions taking place. The priests relied on the landowners to stop the evangelical preachers preaching to the folks who worked on the large haciendas, and both were in league with the local judge, who would duly punish anybody who transgressed. And this was a tremendous barrier, which we can now see, but which we didn't discern then, to the advance of the gospel. And this 1968 revolution did away with that structure. And you can chart from 1968 the tremendous surge of evangelical churches in the Andes Mountains of Peru. You can also compare it to a similar surge in Bolivia amongst the indigenous people following a 1952 revolution which did similar things. When I first landed on Warner Hardy's doorstep in southern Peru in 1973, I suppose in the south of Peru there would have been something like perhaps as many as 200 evangelical churches scattered throughout. Today, 17 years later, we are talking of something like 800 evangelical churches in one part of Peru alone. This is indicative of the tremendous growth that has taken place in those intervening years. So political events have been a factor. Urbanization, which I've already mentioned, has been a factor. Another vital factor which characterizes the Latin American evangelical church is the role of the Bible. And the Bible in the indigenous language. It was in the late 60s that in a number of places the New Testament in the indigenous language was published. And the role of the scriptures in the vernacular has been fundamental in the growth of the church in Peru. And we can see the same thing in Peru's neighboring countries, Bolivia to the south and Ecuador to the north. Tremendous surge growth in the Quechua-speaking world and in the Aymara-speaking world in Bolivia. So the role of the scriptures has been quite crucial, and this continues to be so. In the past 2.5 years, these Andean countries have received not only their New Testament, but also their Old Testament. Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, the church now has the complete Bible in the indigenous language. And this is bearing its fruit. And I hope just to touch on that before I end. But in the last 10 years, nobody has been able to live in Peru without an awareness of violence. This has hit the mountain churches more than anything else. The urban churches to some degree, but it is the mountain churches of Peru who have borne the brunt of the violence waged between the Shining Path guerrillas and the army. Let me read a news clip, if I can find it. This is from Noticias Aliadas, October the 25th, 1990. This is a news bulletin put out by, founded originally by the Marinol Fathers, to provide information about events in Latin America, and specifically, or more specifically, about developments in the church. So it's not an organ which has any sort of axe to grind, or it's not an organ which specifically wants to defend a non-Catholic group. But this is the news that they are publishing about what's happening to evangelicals in the Andes Mountains. The article, Peru, Evangelicals Assassinated. What it says is that in the last 10 years, around 300 evangelical pastors have been killed by the Shining Path. In contrast, in the same period, only one priest and recently one nun have died. These are things which we don't hear about in our media. And in this sense, one speaks, one gives voice to the cry of those who have no voice. We who are evangelicals and who rejoice in the name of evangelical and debate what it means to be evangelical, we are unaware that our brothers and sisters are dying, and sometimes dying the most horrible of deaths. The evangelicals have borne the brunt of the violence in the Andean towns and villages. They're not alone, of course. They're not the only people who have died. That number just relates to pastors. There are many lay people who've died, and many others, almost 20,000 in all. It goes unreported in our own media, and even in our own evangelical press. What has the violence done to our brothers and sisters? It has led them to think seriously about what is the Christian to do faced with violence. And to articulate their own position. To return to the scriptures and find in the scriptures not only comfort and grace in such trial, but to find guidance and guidelines for action in a situation where no missionary is able to help them. As one church leader explained to me, he said, "We believe that God has told us to love." Or, of course, those words can so easily trip off our tongues in a comfortable situation in Scotland. We would all agree with that. But what does loving mean when a young, wounded terrorist who looks no older and indeed is no older than your teenage son stumbles on your door at 10 o'clock at night and obviously needs help, and you take him in and you bind up his wounds and you feed him and you help him because of Jesus Christ, and you wake up in the morning to find he's gone, but later that day to find yourself hauled away by the security forces to be tortured? What does it mean when the army platoon comes to your village? Again, young, innocent men who don't even speak your language, who don't understand you and cannot tell the difference between you and a terrorist, and who would just as easily rape your daughter as they would take your bread. And you feed them, and you give them water, and you give them bread, because they're hungry. They haven't eaten for 36 hours. Knowing that within 24 hours the terrorists will be at your door. Because you're a collaborator. Well, those are very real questions. And they are daily questions. Not only for the Christians in the mountains of Peru, for the Christians in the mountains of Guatemala too, where in the same period, the last 10 years, 100,000 people have died. See, nobody wants to be a community leader in that situation, except the evangelicals. And in becoming community leaders, they again place themselves in the firing line, either in the sights of the terrorists or in the sights of the forces of law and order. We look at it from our perspective and we might say, well, this is very politically naive. But they have nowhere else to go. This is their country. These are their communities. This is their land. There is nowhere to run. And so they come to their God and to His Word. And some of it can be so deeply moving. I worked for a number of years in the translation of the Old Testament, often wondering, well, what would people make of this? This summer, I found part of the answer as I sat with one of my translation colleagues, himself a pastor, a leader in his community, as we wept together. And he told me of three of our friends who had been cruelly assassinated in his village. And as the pastor and as a leader of the community, he was responsible for leading the whole community in mourning. And I asked him, well, what did you do? He said, well, I went to the Word of God. He said, do you remember how we toiled over the Book of Lamentations? Because he was the translator of the Book of Lamentations. He said, that was the book that God brought to me. The very words that I myself had translated, never dreaming that one day they would minister to me and would minister to my people in our deepest tragedy, as we relived the experience of the people of God centuries ago, when they had felt utterly abandoned in the midst of their suffering and pain and agony. And it was that, he said, that came alive to us, and God was with us. And so the Word speaks, and God speaks, in a way that never entered into the mind of the missionary. And the church has grown at a phenomenal rate. And this has spilled over into the cities. The growth of the church in Peru does not owe its origins to wonderful programs of church growth that we missionaries have traced out. It owes its origins largely to a suffering people who are dying for their faith. And it is the standing of those people in their communities throughout the mountains, although they are only a small proportion nationally, it is the standing of those people that caused a nation to elect a president unknown. And 24 evangelical members of parliament. Naive? Well, I don't understand the purposes of God in Peru. And all I can ask you is for your prayers. But what we do see now are people thrust into the cauldron of Peruvian politics. A Baptist lawyer and pastor taking on the task of the country's second vice president, and committing himself to doing something about the horrific state of Peru's prisons. other leaders, one who is known to a number of you here, not himself elected to government, Pedro Arana, Presbyterian pastor in Peru, involved in programs of urban renewal and evangelism in the teeming shanty towns of Lima. All of them struggling to understand what it means to be an evangelical in this crisis-ridden country. Meeting situations that they never believed existed. One of my friends from my first visits and meetings with the Christian Union at Lima's universities, almost 20 years ago, Victor Arroyo, and now in his early 40s, is the secretary to the Senate. And as he entered his job, he thought he should, well, find out what his predecessor had done. And he began to go through the files. And he found out that in order to operate the Senate, you needed a total of 280 employees. Well, that didn't shock him. What did shock him was he found there were 3,000 employees on the payroll. Now, if they all attended, you couldn't put them in the Senate, even if you had wall-to-wall people. So he begins to look through their job descriptions and why it is that these people are not there. So he hadn't seen all these folk. And he comes across a whole section, almost 50 names. And down beside each man's name, and this is in macho Latin America, they're all on maternity leave. I was going to do something about this. He has to. Babes in the Woods. That's one of the funnier things. There is much more that is deeply tragic. But there they are. They're there. Where do they go for their models? And I've already mentioned two of the major models that they're drawing on. One is James Thompson, this remarkable product of the Haldane churches. The James Thompson Teacher Training College is envisaged by many evangelicals as just a building block. For what? For an evangelical university. You see, these people look at this crisis not with the eyes that we missionaries look at it and say, this is impossible. There is no way forward. One of the tremendous paradoxes is the sense of hope that you find in our brothers and sisters there. And our readiness to plan ahead so that this would be the education faculty. The Lima Evangelical Seminary would be the theology faculty. And they would develop other faculties as well. So that there could be an alternative to the way education has been going in recent years in Peru, dominated as it is by Marxist ideology. And so these two Scottish figures strangely play a role in contemporary Peru. The other major element has to do with their reflection on the Word of God, coming to it from their situation, not from our situation. A recognition that much of what we have given to them has brought with it our culture. And a deep concern, especially, for those currents which have come with missionaries, which have allied the church to the right wing of politics. One of the most striking examples I found of this was, there are many, and Stoll's book is full of the situation as it pertains to Guatemala. But I remember in 1987 visiting Paraguay and meeting there with pastors who were, I was involved in planning a translation project. Many of them were involved in planning a big evangelistic campaign. The preacher was to be the man who's on the face of this book, Jimmy Swaggart. They wanted to have the main stadium, the main football stadium, and they were refused. And so they went to the president, President Stroessner, the byword for repression of human rights in Latin America. Stroessner, when he heard of this proposed campaign, picked up his telephone, spoke direct to the director of the national stadium, and he said this. He said, "You will allow these evangelicals the stadium for this man's campaign for as long as they want it, because they're the only people who do not cause me any trouble." Now, the friend who told me this was quite proud of it. It is the other side of the political naivety of many Latin American evangelicals. And at the heart of a reflection on the Word in the Latin American situation, and specifically in the Peruvian situation, is a group which this year has celebrated, or just last year have celebrated, 20 years of existence, called the Latin American Theological Fraternity. At its heart are leaders like Pedro Arana, Samuel Escobar, René Padilla, and others. And it is these men who, as they have lived through the crisis of their people, as they have interacted with the other reality in their subcontinent, which is the Roman Catholic Church, and particularly all that comes from the theology of liberation, have been and are trying to lead the evangelical churches to a biblical understanding of where they are now and where they should be going. And so I leave you with the evangelicals in Latin America. Where are they headed for? To that, I can only put, as I've got on my notes here, a big question mark. It's one of my good friends, now a Peruvian parliamentarian, said to me, he said, "I do not know why I am where I am, but of one thing I am convinced. I could not be here now had not God brought me here." And I believe he speaks for all of them. Thank you.
Well, that's incredibly thrilling and humbling and challenging. We're very grateful to you for it all. Questions for a few moments.
Sorry, let me
stand up. How is the new government and Apple for war? It's a very complex situation. The election showed quite clearly that the people as a nation rejected the far left. The Marxist coalition called the United Left got a mere 8% of the vote. The people as a nation rejected the capitalist solution, which was represented by Mario Vargas Llosa. And they opted for
the man they call the Little Chinaman, El Chinito. Because they felt he was like us. He's come up from below to be what he is. They didn't know what his policies really meant. And in the event, I think they've turned out to be disillusioned, in that it is a kind of rehash of the International Monetary Fund prescriptions, which do little else in the short term than increase the suffering of the poor. The evangelicals as a group, of course, are in their origins. If you can give them origins, if you could classify them, you would have to classify them much more as Anabaptist than Reformed, if I can make that distinction. There is a sense, of course, in which in Latin America, since the Roman Catholic Church is the state church, we're all sort of Anabaptists in our political role. But it means there's a very strong sort of ingredient of a peace position in the evangelical presence. And to try to promote some kind of reconciliation. No, I don't. No, I don't mean pacifist in the sense that you do nothing about it. I mean a sort of constructive seeking for peace and for trying to resolve the situation. The incoming Guatemalan president, Serrano, has been the person in the previous few years who has headed up the delegations to talk with the guerrillas in Guatemala. Well, we haven't come to that in Peru. The other ingredient, which is a fearful ingredient in Peru, is the cocaine trade. Because this is how the guerrillas finance themselves. They finance themselves by taxing the cocaine trade. And a cocaine trade which brings $1 billion dollars into Peru every year. You don't need a very big tax on that to finance a small army. So at the moment, it just isn't clear what is happening in Peru as far as the guerrilla situation is concerned. The people have rejected it, and they would like to build on that. The economic situation is so massive at the moment that the government is just sort of struggling even to sort of tread water. So I don't see any immediate resolution to this.
Roman Catholic priest in the last
the majority of priests and nuns are expatriates. 80% of all priests and nuns in Peru are expatriates. They are not Peruvians. Well, they're from the States, they're from Spain, they're from Ireland, they come from a wide variety of countries. And the expatriates tend to be much more radical than the Peruvians. But by being expatriates, there is a tremendous reluctance of a guerrilla group to kill. In addition, there are just far fewer priests in the mountain areas than expatriates. There are some priests in the Peruvian mountain areas who have an area to cover as big as Grampian region, and with a more difficult geography than Grampian region. You don't see the priest very often, necessarily. Whereas in the operation of Andean towns and villages, the people themselves, as they elect their own representatives, have opted for people whose lives recommend them, people who have already some leadership skills, and these are the evangelical leaders. So one of the the things that, of course, happened in Europe a long time ago, it has happened in Latin America, that where the Bible comes into a situation where you have evangelical churches with lay participation, and in the area where I've worked, the actual form of government has been a Presbyterian form of government, you get this tremendous participation of people learning to lead, learning to do things, developing skills in a way that other people in the communities aren't. And so when you come to have your elections, you elect evangelicals. They're upright, plus they have the skills. But by becoming leaders, whether in the church or in the community, you become a potential focus of opposition to the guerrilla movement. You are a sort of alienating presence in terms of their ideology, and therefore you must be eliminated. And this is the kind of thing that has happened.
You will be preserved, otherwise you might be in very great danger of death.
I can't claim to have been in any danger, at least not that I've been aware of. One of the things is that the brethren there took very good care of you. The churches really look after you. You know, they are concerned about your travel arrangements, about making sure that others are with you, and so on. So I haven't been aware of that. I don't think in its true perspective until you come back to Scotland and you look at it from a distance.
What are the proportions of the armies on the two sides?
Oh, the guerrillas are very... talking about maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people.
Over against the Peruvian army?
Yes, yes.
Which would be...
oh,
thousands.
Thousands and thousands, yes. Oh. But the very... see, the very nature of Peru makes it possible to do things that are difficult to do here. If you have a third of your population living in the capital, and if your capital depends for all its power on hydroelectric plants in the mountains, to which the capital is linked by miles and miles of pylons and cables, it's very simple suddenly to plunge 8 million people into darkness, to paralyze the capital by blowing up power pylons. And you don't need a huge army of guerrillas to do that. Yes. 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 In as much as we understand the ideology of the Shining Path, it is to go back to a pre-industrial society, and almost to in a sense to what they think the Inca Empire functioned as. Well, in sort of a system of basic communes. That's for how they reread the Inca Empire. In Peru. It is a Peruvian movement. The leader was a philosophy lecturer in the University of Ayacucho, Abimael Guzmán, and taught Marxist philosophy for a number of years in the Ayacucho region, which is the poorest and most abandoned area of Peru as far as central government is concerned. Another ingredient which applies specifically to the Peruvian situation is what we would call Andean messianism. There is a sense in which the Shining Path is also a sort of Andean messianic movement. It's a secular messianic movement as opposed to a religious one. But the whole history of Peru has been characterized by messianic movements in the Andes. And this this is an element in this movement as well.